Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Some Pharisees came up, and as a test began to ask Jesus whether it was permissible for a husband to divorce his wife. In reply, he said, What command did Moses give you? They answered, Moses permitted divorce and the writing of a decree of divorce. But Jesus told them, He wrote that commandment for you because of your stubbornness. At the beginning of creation, God made them, male and female. For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become as one. They are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore let no man separate what God has joined. Back in the house again, the disciples began to question him about this. He told them, Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her, and the woman who divorces her husband and marries another commits adultery.
In their customary fashion, the Pharisees present Jesus with a question, which they hope will trap him into an affirmation or a denial. And Jesus, in his fashion, avoids the trap, asking them a question. The decree of divorce, which Moses had allowed, was only allowed to men. In chapter 24 of Deuteronomy, we may read,
Supposing a man has taken a wife and consummated the marriage, but she has not pleased him, and he's found some impropriety of which to accuse her. So he has made out a writ of divorce for her, and handed it to her, and then dismissed her from his house.
This law was supposed to deter divorce, not encourage it, for it gave the woman the right to remarry without civil or religious sanction. The idea was that this would prevent the man from trying to take her back after she'd married another man. This is what the scholars tell us.
Moses tolerated divorce as a lesser evil and prescribed the writ or certificate of divorce so as to limit abuses and restrict the practice. In essence, it was a defense of the woman.
But inevitably there were abuses. And in our Lord's time, we're told, there was much confusion about the grounds for divorce. The rabbis could not agree on what constituted the uncleanness, the impropriety of which the wife could be accused.
There were two opinions. Those following Rabbi Shammai felt adultery was the only grounds for divorce. Those who followed Rabbi Hillel accepted a number of reasons for divorce, including such things as poor cooking.
In 1930, Pope Pius XI issued an encyclical on Christian marriage, Casti Connubi, endorsing and confirming, he wrote, that of his predecessor, Leo XIII, 50 years earlier. And he quoted Pope Leo's words on divorce.
As nothing contributes so effectively to destroying the family and to sapping the strength of the state, as the corruption of morals, it is easy to see that divorce is the greatest enemy of the family and of the state. For divorce is the fruit of depraved public morality. When once facility for divorce has been granted, no curb will avail to restrict its use within definite and prearranged limits. The force of example is great, and the force of passion is greater still. Thus stimulated, the morbid desire for divorce will take hold on the souls of mankind, daily spreading like a contagious disease or like a mighty flood which breaks its banks and overflows. Unless there is a change of heart, family and state must feel themselves in constant danger of a general and complete collapse.
That was 1880. When Pius XI wrote his encyclical, he commented,
How far these prophecies, now 50 years old, have been fulfilled may be seen in the daily increasing corruption of morals.
What these two popes would have to say about the morality of our society and the facility for divorce can easily be imagined. But there's an interesting note in A Social History of the 1930s by Alan Jenkins. Divorce was nothing new, but it was spoken about more freely, almost with bravado, as was evident in entertainment. In 1921, Clements Dane's play A Bill of Divorcement had a long, successful run. And in 1933, all London was humming Cole Porter's Night and Day from the musical Gay Divorce with Fred Astaire. And to follow a red herring, how did that celebrated song come to be born? Well, it so happened that Cole Porter had been staying the weekend with Mrs. Vincent Astor and heard his hostess complaining that a gutter needed mending. "That drip, drip, drip is driving me crazy," she said, which inspired the opening verse of the song, "The drip, drip, drip of the raindrops." And this led to a refrain that was 16 bars too long, out of vocal range. That, said Cole, was inspired by a muezzin calling the faithful to prayers in Morocco.
Shadows fall like the tick-tick-tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip-drip-drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating, you, 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 night and day.
But back to the state of divorce in the 30s, writes Alan Jenkins.
The divorce rate was falling, in America because it was too expensive, in Britain because it was too difficult. One had to go through the dreary farce of staying in a Brighton hotel with a professional co-respondent to prove infidelity.
And there was another thing.
Some of one's friends were the children of marriages made in the 20s, which had now broken up. These children also seemed to be making bad marriages, and some, especially in America, were going to psychiatrists. And so, particularly in Britain, there was a distrust of divorce because it seemed to bequeath its unhappiness to future generations.
As for the unhappiness suffered by those who are obliged to divorce, it's described brilliantly by Evelyn Waugh in his novel Men at Arms, set at the time of the Second World War. His Catholic hero, or rather anti-hero, Guy Crouchback, is in a state of spiritual and emotional aridity when the story opens.
He had no words to describe that wasteland where his soul languished. There was nothing to describe, merely a void. No cosmic struggle raged in his sad soul. It was as though 8 years back he had suffered a tiny stroke of paralysis. All his spiritual faculties were just perceptibly impaired. He was handicapped.
And a few pages later, we're told why.
Guy had married, not a Catholic, but a bright, fashionable girl, quite unlike anyone that his friends or family would have expected. He took his younger son's share of the diminished family fortune and settled in Kenya, living, it seemed to him afterwards, in unruffled good humour beside a mountain lake where the air was always brilliant and keen and the flamingos rose at dawn, first white, then pink, then a whirl of shadow passing across the glowing sky. He farmed assiduously and nearly made it pay. Then, unaccountably, his wife said that her health required a year in England. She wrote regularly and affectionately, until one day, still affectionately, she informed him that she'd fallen deeply in love with an acquaintance of theirs named Tommy Blackhouse. That Guy was not to be cross about it, that she wanted a divorce. "And please," her letter ended, "there's to be no chivalrous nonsense of your going to Brighton and playing the guilty party."
Later in the story, Guy turns the old mosaic law on its head by remarrying his wife, out of compassion, because she is expecting the child of yet another man, and on her death he makes the child his heir. There have been many famous divorces in real life, but none more so than the royal divorce of Henry VIII. However, as the historian G.M. Trevelyan writes,
The immediate cause of the breach with Rome was not, strictly speaking, a question of divorce at all. Technically, it was a question whether or not Henry had ever been properly married to Catherine of Aragon, since his brother Arthur had been her first husband. A former pope had granted a dispensation for her marriage to Henry, but Clement VII was now asked to declare that the marriage had never been valid, and that Henry was yet a bachelor, for he desired to marry Anne Boleyn.
The pope, as we know, could not and did not declare Henry's marriage invalid. So Henry took the law into his own hands. He ordered Thomas Cranmer to write a treatise on the royal divorce. He was to choose between two verses of the Old Testament, the first from Deuteronomy.
If brothers live together and one of them dies childless, the dead man's wife must not marry a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother must come to her and, exercising his levirate, make her his wife.
Levirate comes from the word levier, meaning brother-in-law. The practice of levirate marriage became part of the law of Moses because the Israelites felt it was very important for a man to have an heir. And to preserve the property inheritance God had given them, they had to convey it through family lines. For Henry VIII, too, it was the question of an heir that was all important. The second verse of the Old Testament Cranmer was offered was from Leviticus.
If a man shall take his brother's wife, that is impurity. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness, and they shall die childless.
Naturally, the second quotation was the one preferred by Henry, and that was what Cranmer chose. 4 years later, as Archbishop of Canterbury, he pronounced the marriage to Catherine invalid. As in the Mosaic law, a wife was not allowed to divorce her husband for any reason at all, it followed, as one writer put it, that many women probably fled from unpleasant circumstances without a bill of divorcement. But even in modern times, when divorce is available to men and women, there are those who will flee the conjugal roof without seeking anything more than freedom from the tie. As in this poem by Robert Frost, last in a series of five entitled The Hill Wife. Here is The Impulse.
It was too lonely for her there, and too wild. And since there were but two of them, and no child, and work was little in the house, she was free, and followed where he furrowed field or felled tree. She rested on a log and tossed the fresh chips, with a song only to herself on her lips. And once she went to break a bough of black alder, she strayed so far she scarcely heard when he called her, and didn't answer, didn't speak, or return. She stood, and then she ran and hid in the fern. He never found her, though he looked everywhere, and he asked at her mother's house, was she there? Sudden and swift and light as that the ties gave, and he learned of finalities besides the grave.
In a wedding sermon from his prison cell, the Protestant theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote these words, which might sound strange for such a circumstance.
Live together in the forgiveness of your sins, for without it no human fellowship, least of all a marriage, can survive.
And a similar thought is expressed by the little brother of Jesus, Carlo Carretto.
Not hoping over the negative in man, only wanting to love the positive in him, sooner or later entails defeat.
And he goes on, referring to marriages that have broken down, when one of the partners complains, I seem to be married to a stranger, someone I don't know. Carretto replies,
you have only looked for the positive in him or her. Now you've seen the negative. Everything comes unstuck. The time has come for you to rediscover your partner, to bring your partner to birth from the poor creature's negative aspects. You will see that what is has no connection with what will be, with what is not yet. You must encounter each other in reality, and this is not where you originally met. No one who cannot take this step will ever be able to love his brother for long. But love, real love, begins from here, and from these negative aspects, you have to reconquer the beloved. You end by loving as God loves, loving the negative in man, in the certainty that tomorrow the positive will prevail.
Quite a challenge. And to return to Bonhoeffer's wedding sermon.
Marriage is more than your love for each other. It is not your love which sustains the marriage, but from now on, the marriage that sustains your love.
There's a tendency somehow for us to think that it was Jesus who invented the indissolubility of marriage. But his own words remind us that this is not so. In Matthew's account of this episode, Jesus says,
"Have you not read that the Creator from the beginning made them male and female, and that he said, 'This is why a man must leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and the two become one body? They are no longer two, therefore, but one body. So then, what God has united, man must not divide.'"
And so, as one scholar comments,
"Jesus, with his authority, re-establishes the law of God in its initial purity."
And let's close with the words of another pope on this very theme. In 1789, Pope Pius VI wrote to one of his bishops,
"What God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. Wherefore it is evident that even in the state of nature, and at all events long before it was raised to the dignity of a sacrament, properly so called, marriage was divinely constituted in such a way as to involve a perpetual and indissoluble bond, which consequently cannot be dissolved by any civil law. Therefore, although a marriage may exist without the sacrament, as in the case of marriage between infidels, even so, being a true marriage, it must and does retain the character of a perpetual bond, which from the very beginning has been by divine law inseparable from marriage, and over which no civil power has any authority."
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now we turn our attention to the Synod for Africa, taking place here in the Vatican. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday celebrated a Mass to inaugurate proceedings which officially start on Monday the 5th and last until Sunday the 25th of October. So before briefly mentioning some of the other Vatican events that took place during the week, our resident Vatican expert Joan Lewis sat down to tell me exactly what a synod is, giving me lots of other information as well.
The synod is actually created by Pope Paul VI. He was kind of answering the wishes of all the fathers who had attended Vatican Council II. They'd been in these meetings for years. There was the development of this collegial spirit. And they said, let's keep this up and let's have some kind of body or organization. And so the synod was created actually September 15th,
really?
1965, it was instituted. And then during the last, very last session of Vatican Council II, there was a motu proprio by Paul VI, Apostolica Solicitudo. And if you look at the words, anybody who's a linguist, and I do love the meaning of the origin of words, you've got two Greek words to form this. You have syn, S-Y-N, which means together, and the last part of it comes from hodos, H-O-D-O-S, which means road or way. So a synod is a coming together on a single path, if you will.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's only applied to religious events as well,
right?
Isn't it?
It is only linked to the church. I suppose originally, if you look at the Greek, it probably was an assembly of like-minded people who governed or whatever. But you don't have it in civil government, but you do have it even in non-Catholic churches. Mm-hmm. And you'll read about the Holy Father approving the nomination nomination of so-and-so, well, this would be in the Catholic Church, but approving the nomination of so-and-so who was elected by the synod of his peers.
Well, I've discovered that there are synod fathers, and there's a synod hall in the Vatican as well.
Oh, yes, exactly. Where they will be meeting, that's in the new audience hall, which we speak about every Wednesday when the Pope, has his audiences inside. A very big hall and wonderful viewing, the way it's set up like an arena. Of course, there's screens for people who, might not be able to see the Holy Father that well. It's a good-sized chamber. And then there's offices around it where your translators work there, and then your synod officials have their temporary offices during the
meetings.
And the
Pope is present most of the time during
the... He is. And that can be, that can obviously be his choice. And so, by the way, this is also governed by canons in the Code of Canon Law. Canons 342 to 348 govern a synod. Now, the synod is really a consultative body, but the Holy Father can confer deliberative powers on it. It's directly, the work and everything else is directly under the authority of the Pope, and he assigns the agenda. He calls for a synod, to, like he did with the one next year for the Middle East, and obviously this year. He names members, and others are elected, like by their peers or in the different countries, but he also names members. And then when he wishes, he presides over the synod. And gosh, if you look back in the past, the first synod, I think, was 1969. And if you look in the past, how much John Paul was present. He never missed a synod. And he may have missed one or two meetings of a synod, but he was there all the time. And Benedict has really, done the same thing. And now, interestingly enough, there's three kinds of synods. The one beginning today is the General Ordinary Synod, and that deals with, there's General Ordinary deals with matters of the entire church. There's General Extraordinary deals with matters which, quote, require a speedy solution, and then special sessions that handle matters regarding specific churches or regions. And that, I know there was one for the church in the Netherlands, 20 or so years ago, I think in the 80s. I don't remember extraordinary ones. Off the top of my head, I don't.
But it's a very important moment for church.
Well, certainly,
for the church.
In this case, you've got, bishops of Africa coming together, talking about what's the particular problems in Africa, what... there's 53 nations in Africa, so you're going to have individual problems individual to each nation, and then you will have problems for Africa as a whole, as a continent, issues of justice and peace.
And that is the theme of this
right.
year, peace, justice, and reconciliation.
Right. And you usually have about 250 or so people coming together. There's experts, people that are called experts in various fields. There's
and they get to
guests
intervene as well.
And they do. And so there, time limits on speeches and things like that.
I think 3 minutes for the experts and 5 minutes for the Synod Fathers.
Well, and it's like, gosh, 5 minutes, that would be half the length of the show or something
Absolutely.
Else like that. And how do you describe your nation's hugest problems or your approach, your suggestion, whatever you're
talking
about?
Well, I do
minutes.
Know that they have the possibility of giving a longer paper.
Oh, sure.
Their actual speech they make is a synthesis of that paper, and it must fit into that time.
And I think bells go off or lights go off or something else like
yes.
that to let people know that time's
right.
up,
That's
and on to the, it isn't quite like the UN where a recent world leader, instead of speaking for 15 minutes, spoke for 96. Obviously, that's not going to happen. Things are run very well in Rome. So we'll look forward to a lot of news, and there will be press conferences by the Synod Fathers and the Relator General. Oh, and then we must mention that after Synod is over, there is a council that's set up of maybe 10, 12 members that the Pope appoints, and they come back every so often to do follow-up and report on what follow-up has been achieved in their countries. And then they also, the Synod Fathers, before they leave Rome at the end of October, they will have given to the Holy Father a lot of ideas for a document, which
right.
he will put out maybe even a year after the Synod is over. And it's called the Post-Synodal Apostolic Exhortation.
Goodness.
And so it involves that particular, in this case, it's Africa, and then the particular theme and the ideas that they've come up with the Holy Father. Here's what we need to do in our church. Or for the Universal Church. So you always look forward to those documents. Towards the end, an interesting thing is there aren't so many speeches. The speeches are over, you know, they're programmed for X number of days or weeks. And then at the end, people meet in language groups, roundtable discussions, and more input on a, you know, specific subject. So when you think of the length of it, I mean, you know, 3 weeks, that's a long time for people to, in this case, bishops too, to be away from their dioceses, or priests to be away from their parishes, from their churches. Mm-hmm. But you know, when you got a lot of work to do, you have to set aside that kind of time. So, so good luck to. We will be praying for all of our Synod Fathers.
Right, which takes us back to the rest of the week.
Now, kind of a look
quite,
back,
quite briefly, I think.
Yeah.
Can we just mention
sure.
the highlights of this week?
Well, I think Vatican Radio obviously gave it and the other media a lot of attention. We know that the Pope got back Monday afternoon from 3 days in, and you were there in the Czech Republic, and at the Wednesday General Audience, he spoke briefly about it in different languages and gave a catechesis in Italian, and I thought it was interesting. He did call his trip a pilgrimage and a mission. And he said it was a pilgrimage because of the many saints who bore witness to Christ in the Czech lands through their very holy lives. And it was a mission because at the present time, Europe needs to discover the joy and hope that come from following the Lord Jesus. And of course, we've discovered after the fall of communism and the walls that came tumbling down and so forth, the nations seem to go in the direction of secularism and relativism and everything else, much more so than following more people were practicing Catholics
and
years ago.
And these were all
ago.
The main themes of this trip.
Sure, the secularism. He must have used that word 1,000 times, sure.
That's right.
And, yeah, and you know, when you think about it, really, if I were to be asked what is a recurring theme in Benedict's pontificate, I would have to say his stress on the presence of Jesus Christ in our lives, this person, this historical person who lived, and the Pope's message is don't be afraid of him. Don't be afraid of him, of his church. Don't be afraid to be a follower. He doesn't take anything out of your life. He only gives something to your life. And somehow he just, you know, he must be so frustrated after trips like this, you know, what don't you understand about what I've said? But just
he seemed
don't
very
be afraid
happy
of him.
At the end of the trip.
He looked that way.
He seemed to feel that the Czech people had listened to what he had to say, you know, and that he had sown some seeds, and who knows, you know, how they'll develop.
Good.
But he really felt that they really were listening with
Good.
Their hearts as well as with their ears.
Good.
Thank you very, very much, Joan. Thanks there to Joan Lewis. That's all from the English feature program today, but we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.